I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to present this research, which I suppose really only got underway in earnest in October when I started the postdoc. So in fact, this is the tip of the iceberg for the next 2 years. Some of it is more established and others are kind of in development. So I'd really appreciate your comments and your thoughts in the discussion period. And I also want to thank Nick Brown, the mentor for the postdoc. He gives his regrets, he can't be here. I think he's involved in a performance this week in Belfast. So anyway, with that out of the way, I will begin. In 1980, after months of negotiation drawing on decades of R&D work shared between two multinational giants, the Sony Corporation and Philips, the two members of the consortium agreed on the final text of a standard document that specifies in great detail a new digital medium for the storage and playback of recorded sound, the Compact Disc Digital Audio Standard. The colour of its cover lent its document this nickname, the Red Book. Technical standards are important if sometimes overlooked objects of research. Even though they exist primarily as texts, the actors and institutions that consume them use them to shape the world outside of that text. Standards are, as the sociologist Lawrence Bush has put it, quote, recipes for reality. Once the Red Book was formally adopted by the International Electrotechnical Commission as IEC 908, Sony and Philips suspended their close collaboration on the engineering principles of the CD and began to compete with each other as manufacturers of discs and of their players. In theory then, thanks to the standard, it would not matter whether a CD player was produced by Sony, Philips, or any other manufacturer who paid royalties to the owners of the patents that were described in the standard. All would accept and play Redbook-compliant compact disc media. The first CD players appeared in Japan in late 1982, accompanied by select album releases by major record industry players, chosen specially to demonstrate the format's best features to the select market that could afford such equipment, which cost just shy of $750 back in the 80s. This new format boasted digitally controlled track playback, an impressive, if not uncanny, signal-to-noise ratio, and a compact and durable material medium that was difficult to crack and less vulnerable to scratches and dust than vinyl. Manufacturers at the time made various extravagant claims for the durability and fidelity of the format. For example, they said, you can touch the disc surfaces with your fingers, true enough. You can play frisbee with them, less true. And the sound quality is perfect. But from the mid-1980s on, a handful of experimental musicians and sound artists, primarily in the United States, took to deliberately modifying and destroying CDs and their players. These artists mounted speculative attacks on this new medium in search of new sounds that would, in the moment of performance, cast aspersions on this myth of digital perfection peddled by manufacturers and record labels. In this talk, I will focus on some of the music that arose from these experiments and highlight its relationship with the more general electronic music subgenre of glitch. I'll first briefly review the existing literature on glitch music that emphasizes its affiliation with earlier experiments with recorded sound media. Play a representative example by the glitch music ensemble Oval, not consortium, but collective, the kind of loose affiliation of musicians. Then, focusing on a piece for string quartet and modified CD player by Nicholas Collins, I argue that this composer works at the limits of the compact disc medium, exploiting features of standard compliant players that are nevertheless left unspecified in the text of the Red Book. And in the third and final section, I'll explore the possibility of a non-medium-specific glitch aesthetic. I advance a candidate definition of glitch that is broad enough to cover both the music by Oval, Collins, and others, as well as contemporary glitch works that continue to be made today by visual artists and filmmakers. So first, glitch in music. Glitch music is a subgenre of commercial electronic music in which the sounds of failure of sound reproduction technology are used as musical material. Sometimes, but not always, to the exclusion of any other kind of sound. In a short but often cited article on the subgenre from 2001, producer and musician Kim Cascone inventoried the technological failures that a glitch musician might use as basic musical material in a glitch work. For example, glitches, bugs, application errors, system crashes, clipping, aliasing, distortion, quantization noise, and even the noise floor of computer sound cards. In the music of Oval, for example, the clicking sound of the CD is used to rhythmically accompany a pre-composed pattern which is programmed into a relatively conventional drum sequencer. In this excerpt from Oval's 1994 release, 94 Discount, we hear the characteristic click of a subtly skipping CD. fragmented samples which are derived from another recorded piece of music for string ensemble, as well as the made-to-order synth patterns that characterize the work of Obel. Just play that briefly. So that's just the first kind of 1.5 minutes of that track. It's representative, if you like, of what people labeled as glitch music within this sort of subgenre during the 1990s. Not all glitch music, but it's a representative example. So that's why I spent some time like getting into it. That's what you should think of when you think of what glitch means in music to a music critic in the 90s and the 2000s. Throughout his extensive scholarship on the history of sound reproduction technology, Jonathan Stern elaborates the thesis that perceptions of the transparency or fidelity of audio recording processes in the industrialized West are both socially and historically contingent. Mark Katz has similarly described what he calls a discourse of realism, the idea prevalent by the end of the 20th century that recorded sound is a, quote, mirror of sonic reality, the sonic reality of some underlying musical performance. To parrot the contrivances of ad executives at Sony and Philips, the CD promised perfect sound forever. This audio ethic of purity and perfection, encapsulated by this aphorism, ensured that the clicks, pops, skips, and so on that typify glitch music were heard as noise rather than signal by consumers thought to express or to expect a clean, crystalline sound from this new medium. One may argue, as Kim Kaskonik suggests, that this was the chief aesthetic contribution of glitch music. It rehabilitated such normally undesired noise of the sound-carrying medium as desired musical signal. Obel's music is a key reference point for Kaskonik's discussion of glitch in music because of their working process. To prepare their early releases, Obel borrowed dozens of CDs from lending libraries in order to mark the surfaces of these borrowed discs with scratch-off marker and tape, deliberately but reversively damaging the medium. Doing so caused the disc to skip, click, and otherwise make the sounds of the CD, quote, coping with the loss of binary information, as Caleb Kelly somewhat anthropomorphically put it. Obel recorded these sounds, curating a digital archive of sonic glitches, and would later draw on this extensive database of found sounds in the careful construction of their tracks, completed with the help of consumer digital audio workstations, usually their laptop. Glitch Music's use of the sounds of CD skips and other CD-specific noises exemplify an acute case of what Mark Katz calls a phonograph effect, a change in music composition that has, quote, arisen in response to sound recording technology, end quote. Kaskonik finds precedence for Obel's work in the early 20th century of experiments with optical soundtracks by Oscar Fischinger and Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, but also in the more recent manipulations of vinyl records by John Cage and Christian Markley. So Christian Markley's work in particular includes a limited release of a vinyl without a cover in 1985, in order to increase the chance that it would pick up noise from media damage through transportation and use, and the sale of another limited run of records entitled Footsteps, A couple of thousand records, I think, that were first sold after being scattered across the floor of a public exhibition space in Zurich in 1989. In Cracked Media, The Sound of Malfunction, 2009, Caleb Kelly develops a longer history of the, or a more refined history of these experiments that is slightly more sensitive to the particularities of digital media. Kelly identifies the work of the Fluxus affiliate, Yasuo Nautone, and the compositions of Nicholas Collins as additional important precursors or influences on Ovo's music. In the 1980s and the 1990s, Tone experimented with the behavior of CD players, creating what he called wounded CDs, discs that he pockmarked with scotch tape and adhesive labels and used in live electronic sets as early as 1984 and in choreographed dance performances by 1986. Tone, whose work Collins was aware of, was one of the first musicians to identify the potential of modified CDs as a new source of sounds for experimental composition. Many of these artists serve as an important point of triangulation in my research into the mediality of the compact disc, and there will be much to say about each of them as it goes on, but for now, it suffices to provisionally concur with Cascone and Kelly on their finding that these artists have been influential on the development of glitch music during the 1990s in general, and in particular, for Kelly, is at least on the music of Nicholas Collins, to which we now turn. So this is Nicholas Collins' piece, Broken Light. Broken Light is a 15-minute electroacoustic work for, quote, string quartet and modified CD player, written by the American composer and sound artist Nicholas Collins in 1991. In his compositions and in his teaching, Collins has pioneered an empirical, experimental approach to the use of consumer electronics in electroacoustic music and sound art. Broken Light is one of at least five compositions by Collins that explores the limit conditions of the compact disc medium in a similar fashion. In a 1997 interview, Collins describes a distinctive feature of CD player technology that caught his interest early on as in experiments with the format and led directly to the composition of Broken Light. He says, "I went inside the CD player and looked because I suspected, and I was right, that the laser was always on, reading information off the disc, even when you're on pause or moving from track 1 to track 30. It's always reading information, but the control computer censors the output, decides for us what is music, which is to say, the clean playback, and what is noise, scratching, skipping. So I found that control signal, marked mute, and I simply flipped the pin off the chip so that it could no longer mute anything. And that opened the door to the inner world of the CD. You could hear anything that the CD player was doing at any time." This deceptively simple intervention made possible Broken Light. By disabling this muting feature of the CD player, Collins could use a consumer CD player to effectively suspend musical time in short, repeating musical snippets from an underlying source record. These fragments are easily recognized as relating to the skipping CD sound thanks to the distinctive click of wideband noise heard at the beginning of each iteration. So let's play the first few minutes now of a recording of the first movement by the ensemble for which this piece was composed, the Soldier Quartet. From time to time, written instructions in the score, which we don't have right now, invite members of the quartet to imitate the sounds made by the CD player, a compositional technique Collins expanded in his later CD-related works. So when we're listening, I suppose, listen out for that. And this is the movement that'll be the basis for the rest of what I talk about. Thank you. So, the kind of key question then in my research and for, oh, whoops, it's not that, but this. How do we hear the Red Book in all this music? That's kind of the core motivating question, in fact. Like, what would it mean to hear the contents or to understand the content of a technical standard through a piece of music or some sort of oral experience? With reference to the technical standard, we first note that audio CDs contain timing and control information about the location of and extent of the individual tracks on the disc, in addition to the audio data that makes up the majority of the data on the disc. This metadata, data about data, also indicates the position of each sub-second chunk of audio in relation to the start of the current track and to the disc as a whole. Ken Pohlman's précis of the contents of the Red Book, each chunk of digital music data is indexed with respect to clock time by interleaving time codes in between the audio frames using a technique called subcoding. The basic idea behind subcoding is that every chunk or frame of sampled audio that is stored on a CD is prefixed with 8 bits of extra data, which can be used to digitally represent non-audio information, timing information, arbitrary text, and even in certain cases, graphics. Now, CD players have long allowed listeners to jump immediately to the start of any track in an arbitrary order in complete silence, either by programming a sequence of track numbers or using the skip track button. But this feature that we now consider to be standard in all CD players was once viewed as an innovation. Sony even took trouble to brand this functionality, naming the feature Automatic Music Sensor, or AMS, after a similar feature in electronically controlled commercial tape decks. A feature like AMS can be understood as a way of de-skilling the art of sequencing individual tracks for playback, also known as queuing. In the vinyl age, this required mastery of the art of the needle drop. In the age, or in the case of cassette tape recordings, precision queuing became even more difficult, all but impossible without scrubbing through the tape to find the start of a track. Stephen Connor, among others, has noted an apparent decrease in the legibility and addressability of recording media over time, from gramophone through tape to CDs. By giving users programmable control over the sequence of track playback using a technology such as this, manufacturers attempted to mitigate the loss of control that users felt as they were presented with an increasingly inscrutable technical medium. Volker Strabel has pointed out that musicians also responded to this new capacity of the CD player by creating media-specific compositions that encourage listeners to program their players to play tracks out of sequence, that is to say, out of the traditional album order, theretofore fixed by limitations of previous recording media. As commonplace as it is now, listening to recorded media out of order was a new musical experience afforded by the technological developments in digital audio that underwrite the CD format. And I'll return to this thought in the specific context of Glitch towards the end. To affect this new musical experience, manufacturers designed players so that they would move silently from track to track by muting the player's output whenever the laser pickup is deemed to have entered a transition state, for example, when skipping tracks, when paused, or when seeking. It was exactly this behavior that Collins set out to disable in Broken Light. Shown here is a detail from one of his modified players, showing the lifted pin which prevents the microcontroller inside the CD player from passing mute commands onward to the audio output system. I've also included a schematic of the entire circuit of the Discman model he used just for context, so like it's just a small part of a much larger system, but you can see in the black box the mute pin, if you can look very closely, each of the functions of the pins are labeled. And so it was a combination of exploring with the device and with reference to this material that he was able to make this amendment or adjustment to the device. The hardware hack behind Broken Light, while both inspired and immensely generative, is in some sense trivial from an electronic perspective. Just one circuit needed to be excised from the Discman. Not every player made this hack possible in this way. Though almost every single player was Red Book compatible, it did not necessarily implement these playback features in exactly the same way. Indeed, Collins admitted that his practice depended on knowledge of particular playback devices, noting that he, quote, designed most of his pieces around the behavior of specific models, and substitutions oftentimes significantly change the character of a work. Unfortunately, he continues, with each improvement that Sony introduced to their product line, the glitch artifacts grew milder, and the general trend toward integration of more and more functions on fewer discrete integrated circuits made it increasingly difficult to defeat the mute function. It was for these reasons in particular that Collins, Tone, and many other musicians whose practice centered on damaging compact discs in this way sought out older CD players for their work. The seemingly pure engineering problem of how to implement a technical standard is rather an interpretative process. Recent work in STS has shown that these interpretations take place in the context of manufacturer research and development. which in the case of audio standards often involves extensive listening tests by consumer panels and by engineers themselves. In his pioneering study of the MP3 format, Stern demonstrated that the cumulative effect of these audio testing regimes is the encoding of particular values into the capabilities of a medium. The way that MP3 compression algorithm was tuned by its designers determines the kinds of recordings and users the new medium is determined to be good for. We might tell an analogous story for the Redbook standard and its many implementations. At the dawn of commodity digital audio around 1982, it is electronic circuits and microcontrollers that encode the outcomes of these processes of interpretation. These circuits perform what Collins evocatively referred to in the interview as the censoring function of CD players. In the final analysis, the algorithmic policies of sonic control encoded into this hardware enforce a particular set of values about what counts as signal, since they constrain what in a given recording medium is made available to the typical user in ordinary usage. By hotwiring or hacking these players, both terms that Collins uses music composition to trouble the assertion that what is muted or excised from the listening experience by compact disc players during their, quote, normal operation is surplus to consumer expectations, valueless or aesthetically vacant. Broken light exposes the contingency of our present situation with respect to the technical medium of the compact disc and argues otherwise. Okay, so now for the final section. Glitch music and glitch art more generally. Coarsely speaking, outside of music and sound studies, the formal hallmarks of glitch art include the more or less constructivist use of image digitization artifacts, side effects that arise from the lossy translation of reality into discrete bits and bytes. In an introduction to his 2009 visual anthology of glitch art, Iman Moradi characterizes the composition of most glitch art as, quote, incongruously linear, complex, sharp, and occasionally blurred. Fragmentation, linearity, complexity, and repetition are the more common meta-qualities of visual glitches, end quote. Pixelation, downsampling, compression, the traces of perceptual codecs are all adapted as formal elements in new born digital glitch works. A much discussed example of the glitch art practice known as data moshing, Paul B. Davis's compression study number 1 evidences the fragmented patchwork structure of the MPEG video compression algorithm as it interpolates digital material from a number of found music video clips, including by Rihanna and from the Cranberries. Most of the glitch works I've shown here illustrate what Carolyn L. Kane has recently called chroma glitch, the manifestation of the underlying structure of digitally encoded images in color palettes that are surprising or unnatural according to traditional theories of color. As we begin to think about the possibility of a medium-independent theory of the glitch, it's notable that Kane's analysis depends, or rather is structured by a concept that is well-developed with respect to visual art, namely color, but can only go so far if we try to read it across directly to music. Provincialism of a similar kind can be found in writing about glitch in music studies too. Elliot Bates, for example, writing in 2004, defines glitch as, quote, that which betrays the fidelity of the musical work, the skipping CD or record, the mangling cassette tape, the distorting PA system. A definition of the phenomenon that's as good as far as it goes, which is to say only as far as Bates' interest in music alone can take him. Such talking at cross purposes is symptomatic of what I think are two distinct bodies of writing, relating separately to glitch music on the one hand and glitch art on the other. So, is there any hope for a unified medium-independent definition of glitch that cuts across diverse media? Is there a broader glitch aesthetic that is common to all the arts, or is glitch something unique to each medium, a possibility that would seem to explain the incommensurability of these two bodies of writing? Digitalization is supposed to level out the differences between media, replacing its substrate with the universal binary vocabulary of zeros and ones, of on and off. But to follow this line of reasoning with respect to glitch art is to beg the question of glitch's digitality. Is glitch a distinctively digital phenomenon at all? Is it even necessarily technological? And if not, can human beings and animals be said to glitch too? Recent writing on glitch in video suggests one line of inquiry in this general direction. For the film theorist Michael Betancourt, the roots of glitch reach beyond the mid-century formalist film experiments normally invoked in the history of glitch in the visual arts. Betancourt turns to the longer history of 20th century art, not to reclude glitch works into a sequence of precursor works with similar formal features, for example, the fragmentation, replication, linearity Moradi considers glitch definitional. Instead, he seeks out operational affinities between art practices, seeking out the most general statement of the glitch gesture and finding much of interest in the early 20th century Dada movement. Marcel Duchamp's notion of the stoppage turns out to be central to Betancourt's discussion of glitch video art. In Duchamp's practice, the stoppage is the arbitrary and sudden termination of a mechanical process, exemplified in the French artist's early 20th century sculptures and musical performances. His Three Standard Stoppages of 1914 is a sculptural instantiation of this concept. To realise this work, Duchamp dropped metre-long lengths of street from a height of a metre and used the shape that they traced out to cut three wooden curves that memorialise the instant of stoppage, to memorialise the instant of stoppage as the string hit the ground. To demonstrate the applicability of Duchamp's concept of the stoppage to glitch art, Betancourt discusses an early, if not the earliest, example of a digital video glitch work. Digital TV Dinner was created by the Chicago-based video artists Jamie Fenton and Raoul Zaritsky in 1978. By thumping a Bally Astrocade home video games console, Fenton and Zaritsky created what they call, quote, garbage references in the stack frames and invalid pointers, which caused strange patterns to be drawn on the screen. These strange patterns became basic visual elements of their glitch work. Writing about Digital TV Dinner in particular, Betancourt explains that although the imagery of the work is, quote, serially structured in repeating fashion, end quote, that we might think to be stylistically characteristic of glitch, he goes on to say, the imagery that does appear cannot be predicted or controlled with the same precision as graphics specifically generated by code. This performance aspect shifts what appears from the reel of programming executed automatically to the particular touch of the individual handling the machine. It seems to open the autonomous protocols of the machine, controlled in advance by the strictures of the code, to the vagaries of human interaction. The violence, beating it with your fist, that provides this interruption is at the same time a performance intervention that breaks the normative flow of processes and autonomous actions, a human-determined stoppage that redirects the machine. Thumping the video game's console temporarily unseats the cartridge containing the game code and engineers the stoppage that leads these shapes to the cathode ray tube. Each blow suddenly and arbitrarily interrupts the mechanical processes carried out by program code. As Betancourt notes, despite the evident structure in the images that result, glitch artists are not entirely in control of the formal features of their work, such as its visual composition. Many important formal features of the work are rather epiphenomena of the media that they work with, a consequence of a digital grid implicit in the particular device that is used to organize the layout of data for interaction and playback. In the case of Digital TV Dinner, this grid is latent in the address maps, which orient game programmers within the contents of the Astrocade's memory. The Bally Astrocade must read the contents of this digital reservoir in the correct order to build up a PAL-compliant TV signal that matches the intentions of the programmer. So there's these structures. Similarly, the CD player must reconstruct the order of audio frames as they are read off a disc, ensuring that the order in which information reaches the listener closely approximates the order in which it was recorded, and ultimately the way it was performed. But as we've seen, the CD does not store audio information in a single uninterrupted track. It is rather pockmarked with timing data contained in the subcode channels. The job of a Redbook-compliant player is then in part to reverse this interleaving process and represent the information in an order that makes sense with respect to the original recording event. CD players, as Collins' works demonstrates, autonomously process and reject data unfit for sounding, filtering out timing and error correction data, as well as the sounds of seeking, and so on, to recover what a phonorealist might understand to be the sonic event that underlies the recording. In both cases, many concurrent timing processes, called clocks, ensure that data is read out correctly from each of these locations in such a fashion so that the original temporal order of the data is more or less preserved. When something or someone intervenes in the system to precipitate a stoppage, causing a disturbance in the mechanisms in which timing data is encoded, the temporal integrity of these timekeeping systems is threatened. As a result, the system outputs information that no longer conforms to the structures intended by the designer of that system, what we hear or see as a glitch. We might tentatively redefine glitch, then, as just such an intermittent failure to correctly reorder stored representations of reality in time, whether or not those representations be ultimately interpreted as sounds or images or some other perceptual form. On this view, the gap between glitch music and glitch art, that divide which is both mirrored and maintained by what presents itself to me, at least, as two parallel discourses, begins to narrow once both are seen to be concerned with the failure of a temporal process of reordering. An off-cited definition by Goryanova and Shulgin in Software Studies, a lexicon from 2008, defines Glitch as, quote, a mess that is a moment, a possibility to glance at software's inner structure. Although a glitch does not reveal the true functionality of the computer, they continue, it shows the ghostly conventionality of the forms by which digital spaces are organized. In a similar vein, the digital media theorist Jacob Gabori more recently has noted that a glitch, quote, lays bare its material function, end quote. These definitions wear their ocular centrism on their sleeves, as it were. If all that glitch offers is the possibility to glance at the workings of a particular technology, by revealing, by showing, by laying bare, then any such disclosure is partial, since it overlooks, quite literally, those aspects of glitch that are better suited to analysis in terms long used to qualify musical phenomena. As robustly theorized as they may be, hewing too closely to definitions of glitch that reflect the priorities of the visual arts will fail to resolve glitch's sonic contours, namely, the rhythmic, tonal, and processual qualities of the glitch, qualities with which music studies has been long familiar and should be prepared to consider seriously as such. Thank you.